You are listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, depending on where you are joining us from. I'm Rebecca Winthrop. I am the co-director with my colleague Emiliana Vegas of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. It is a real pleasure to be with you today and host a conversation around gender equality. This event is called How to Be a Feminist Dad, and there is never a more important moment to talk about gender equality and particularly the role of men in the movement of gender equality in the US in particular than now. 4.5 million women have left the workforce because of the pandemic. And we know that women do on average 2 hours of housework more and care work more than men at home, even when they are either equally breadwinners or the sole breadwinner. And it's and the pandemic has been incredibly hard, as we also know, on single parents and single moms in particular. There's a great quote from a sociologist, Jessica Coloroco, saying, "Other countries have social safety nets, but the U.S. has women." And I am really pleased to be hosting this conversation with two incredible people who've long been committed to gender equality. This is a book launch for Jordan Shapiro, who is a close colleague of mine here at the Brookings Institution. He is a non-resident fellow, and he is also a senior fellow at the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at the Sesame Workshop. He teaches at Temple University at the Intellectual Heritage Program. And those of you who have followed his work over time, as I have done very closely, know that he's a guru on technology and gaming and new forms of raising children in a digital world, and has a lot of advice for parents on that front. And he has branched out in his new book, Father Figure, How to Be a Feminist Dad, that he will be talking about today in conversation with our other featured speaker. And that book really takes on gender equality, and particularly thinking about the family and masculinity and the role of men in that movement. And we're very pleased to have you, Jordan. And Jordan will be in conversation with Tina Chen, who we're very, very excited to welcome back to Brookings, who's spoken here in the past around gender equality issues. Tina is the president and chief executive officer of Time's Up and the Time's Up Foundation. I first knew her and began to work with her when she was in the Obama administration. She wore many hats and was very influential. She was the executive director of the White House Council on Women and Girls, chief of staff to the First Lady Michelle Obama, and of course, last but not at all least, assistant to President Obama. I knew Tina because she was very much championing the work that Michelle Obama was doing on Let Girls Learn on gender equality through girls' education, both in the U.S. and around the world. But I also remember some of the amazing things she also did well at the White House around stay-at-home dads. Tina really championed the first summit, White House Summit on Working Families, and one of the sessions was for stay-at-home fathers. And I think that was the first time there'd ever, I think, Tina, you can correct me when you come on screen, the first time there'd ever been a White House event focused on stay-at-home fathers. And it had been just after Daniel Thomas Murphy, who's a major baseball player, faced a massive backlash from the public for being present at the birth of his child. And so Tina has always been pushing this issue of gender equality and role for men. So please, Tina and Jordan, please do come onto the screen and we will get started with a great conversation. Thank you both very much for being here.
Oh, delighted to be here.
I want to start off with a question to both of you. Maybe Jordan, you should kick off because you've written a book and put it out there. I wanted to ask you both, really, why is it that you do this work? What motivates you? What drives you? You, Jordan, you've had many directions of your research. And yes, parenting has always been a theme, but I think of you more in the digital space. So tell us about why you dove in. And similarly, Tina, you could have gone in many directions post-White House, and you really chose Time's Up. And I know you have a long commitment to gender equality, but what was it that drove you to choose that role? So Jordan, why don't you kick off?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation. I decided to write father figure. I had been writing about parenting for a long time. I had been writing about education. I had talked to a whole lot of dads, and it became really clear to me that there was a huge sort of backlash, especially in the U.S., against what was a move towards gender equality. And there was sort of like a backlash of misogyny. And the more that I thought about that from a psychological perspective, the more it became clear that that was sort of a compensation, a reaction to a lack of stability, right? As terrible as patriarchy is in the way that it's manifested, it's still the thing that gave identity to a lot of men and gave identity to a lot of fathers. And so I believed that what was happening was, as we were renegotiating issues around gender and gender equality in the U.S., you had men going, oh, no, I don't know how to make sense of myself without this. Like, and there was no image of that. I mean, even today, as we're a lot further than we were even 5, 6 years ago, there's still no image. Still, most of what you see on TV, most of what you see in the movies, most of what you see on the internet, most of what you read about is a very old school version of what it means to be man and what it means to be father. So what I wrote this book because I felt like people needed something to hold on to. It was like the floor was falling out from under them and they were falling. And so they grabbed the first handrail they could find, which was old school, angry, patriarchal dominance, violence. You see all these people writing these books about it. And I was like, well, let's just give them another option. Because what I really found as I talked to men is that if you walked up to them all and said, do you believe in gender equality? They all said, yes. If you say, do you believe in feminism? They go, oh, that word's too strong. But if you say gender equality, they say yes. But they don't really know how to do it, because so much of the important work that feminist theory has done over the last few generations has been about deconstructing and calling out the problems. And what we haven't done yet is really reconstructed it from a man's perspective. And that's what I really wanted to do with this book. And I decided to focus on fatherhood because patriarchy literally means rule by the father. And I was like, how come nobody has really said, let's unpack everything that's in fatherhood? Because if we're going to try to reorganize the patriarchy, we have to first organize that patri, right? That patriarch, right? At the top, and reimagine what it can be and what it means and what it means to not be at the top anymore, to just be on an equal horizontal footing. And so that's what I was trying to do with father figure. And it seemed like an important time to do it. And it seemed like a logical thing to do from my position as someone who was well known as an expert in parenting, because at the core, I think this is about modeling something different for our children.
Thanks, Jordan. I have a follow-up question before I come to you, Tina. You talked about, you know, all the images that we see out there were not, basically how we form our sort of beliefs, our social norms, are not supporting this vision that you're trying to give of a feminist dad. And what I wanted to do is throw you a question, because we have a number of questions from the audience. And this is a question from William, who's a professor at University of Pennsylvania, and says, how do we take account of all the clown father figures in media, the Homer Simpsons, the Archie Bunkers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You know, it strikes me as you're trying to counter that.
Yeah, I mean, I write a bit about that in Father Figure, about that clown figure, I call it the bumbling idiot dad, right? It's often what we get in sitcoms is the dad who's kind of dumb. But if you really look at all of those, and in my research, I spent a lot of time, you know, it's great to write research like this because you get to spend a lot of time watching The Simpsons and pretend it's research. but when you really look at it, they still have that dominant ultimate ability, that authority. They're just dumb until the moment where they have to make the final choice. And then they always make the right final choice. And so even those images, I think, are still selling that. I mean, there's another way to think about it too, which is by having the bumbling idiot, we're also reinforcing what you were talking about in your intro, Rebecca, which is this idea that women are going to maintain the home so that the bumbling idiot can come home and drink beer and still be in charge and no one's going to talk about it. So, you know, all of that's one image. Maybe during this conversation, we'll get to some of the other images that I think are ubiquitous in our culture of problematic images of either misogynist or sexist or patriarchal fathering, which is not what you get when you talk to most fathers. It's not what they want, but they are still, at least the way I think about it, they're sort of engaged in behaviors, habits of mind, ways of thinking that betray their own values, right? They just don't see it, right? Nobody wants to be teaching their daughter that you're worthless, and yet you do all these things that inadvertently send that message, whether you mean to or not. And so part of what I wanted to do in Father Figure was unpack that and help people see where their own behaviors are betraying what they want. Right?
Great. So Tina, what about you? You've been at this for quite some time. So, you know, why Time's Up? What motivated you?
Well, thank you, Brooke and Jordan. There was so much in your answers. I have to say that was so rich. So as you point out, look, I've been doing gender equity work really since my entire adulthood. I mean, I often relate that lifelong commitment to the fact that right after college in the 1970s, I found myself living in Springfield, Illinois, which is the capital here, just at the moment when Springfield was, of all places, the center of American feminism, because it was the focal point for all the efforts at that point to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. We were just three states short of the number needed to put the Equal Rights Amendment into the U.S. Constitution, and Illinois was the only northern industrial state that had not ratified. So it became the linchpin. And, you know, here I am in my 20s, you know, every major feminist leader is coming to Springfield. I'm working for a state government by day, but taking my lunch breaks to go stand in the rotunda, you know, opposite Phyllis Schlafly and her folks on the other side of the rotunda. So it was a very heady time to get this crash course in feminism. And then, you know, it sort of shaped then the rest of my career. You know, I was always very active politically, very committed to gender justice issues, became a single working mom my whole career when I was a practicing corporate lawyer for 2 decades, before, you know, along the way happening to meet a guy who got elected president, which is how I wind up in the White House. And that White House years, as you noted in your introduction, those were the years where for the first time, part of my day job was actually to work on women and girls issues in my capacity as executive director of the Council of Women and Girls. So after the White House, I was like fully prepared and in fact did for 2 years, went back into private practice, although working at that point on helping companies work on issues like corporate culture, the issues we explored at the White House Summit on Working Families. And then just again, in the luck of being in the right place at the right time, happened to be in Los Angeles in the fall of 2017, at the moment where women of Hollywood were coming together in the wake of the revelations about Harvey Weinstein's sexual harassment in the entertainment industry. And just then continued to work with that group of women as they started to think about, well, what do we do as we turn our pain into action? Helped found the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund as one of the responses. Tried actually for the next 2 years to not actually come work at the organization as we were forming it, because I was not going to work at a not-for-profit. But then was convinced by my friends, you know, on the board and in Time's Up to come on and do this job full time in the fall of 2019. And, you know, it's interesting to hear, you know, Jordan, you talk about culture and the, you know, outsized cultural influences. You know, we continue to work, you know, on these issues around safe, fair, and equitable work across every industry, but we're still maintain heavy activism in the entertainment space, both because we need safer workplaces in entertainment, and also because we need more representation in entertainment, because entertainment does have an outsized effect on our culture. You know, what are those images that we're seeing? Mm-hmm. What are the things that are shaping our social norms? And so staying active in that space, you know, has remained very important to us at Time's Up, even though, you know, we work for survivor justice everywhere, and we're working for safer and dignified work everywhere.
And it strikes me, this is a question I want to ask you, Tina, as a follow-up. It strikes me that Jordan was talking about the reason he wrote this book is he felt like there was a very specific moment right now where there seems to be sort of a shifting of patriarchal norms to another, perhaps more equitable set of norms, perhaps, and a reaction and by people who didn't have an identity outside of a patriarchal structure. And so trying to provide an alternative. So I'm asking you, Tina, because you've been at many pivotal moments in the last several years for the gender equality movement. So is there something uniquely urgent or specific about this moment right now that we need to think about? And how, what is it? You have a long history to compare it to. What would you think? And then Jordan, I'll ask you the same question.
Yeah, no, absolutely we're at a pivotal moment. I mean, the other reason I took this job full time was even before we got to the pandemic, you know, I think the moment that we saw around sexual harassment and women in the mm-hmm. workplace in the fall of 2017, you know, the outpouring of women and men telling their stories.
Me too movement.
Absolutely. Using Tarana Burke's hashtag Me Too, mm-hmm. you know, which led to then the founding of Time's Up and the expansion of Me Too, you know, into a broad-based international movement. There already was this realization, right, that the way we have organized work literally in this country for the last two centuries, right, since the Industrial Revolution was no longer working, right, for women, for men. It wasn't then. It wasn't when at the time we were doing the White House Summit on Working Families. We've got the persistent equal pay gap. We've got no paid leave. You know, we start this pandemic as one of only two countries in the world without a national paid leave. So that was already happening. And, you know, war for talent in the knowledge economy we have in a globally competitive economy. American companies were realizing they had a stake in this. Well, then the pandemic hits, and now the urgency I may have felt, you know, 2 years ago is just doubled down because the pandemic has really exposed those fissures that existed pre-pandemic around the lack of structural things like paid leave and childcare and elder care, you know, the persistent discrimination against women and LGBTQIA, you know, disabled and people of color in the workplace. And now we see it. We see it in this K-shaped recovery, right? Where the, you know,
and
coming
out. What
do you
mean by K-shaped, just in case?
So, you know, first of all, the pandemic, we know from all the data, had a disproportionate impact on low-wage workers, you know, folks who are in the hospitality industry, you know, in all the things that shut down, restaurants, who are frontline workers who nonetheless still had to keep working, even though schools were closed and childcare centers were closed and trying to figure out what to do with their kids or their elderly loved ones. So that already hit, and we can see it in the persistent, you know, women of color are lagging behind white men in the, you know, unemployment rates and the recovery from it. And we know now that, you know, upwards of 2 million women have left the workforce completely. Women's labor force participation is now at its lowest level since the 1980s. So in 1 year, we've wiped out several decades of progress. And the K-shaped recovery is, even as the stock market has risen, right, as, you know, those, you know, certain industries, financial services and others that started to take a hit last spring have fully recovered, you know, and are doing great, right, in terms of their business models. Low-wage workers, hourly workers, workers in those vulnerable industries, workers in things like caregiving and childcare centers are suffering, right, are not recovering as quickly, are seeing their incomes drop. You know, they're being supported right now with the government supports. This is not what's keeping them from going back to work, by the way. This is just keeping them alive and their families with roofs over their heads at the moment. And so, you know, this urgency to redesign our American economy in ways that will address women and the inequities, for example, just to bring us back to the topic mm-hmm. that yes. we're talking about, You know, we need to do it to address the inequities that in particular have kept women out of the workplace for so long, like caregiving. So it's why, you know, Time's Up, you know, a whole coalition of organizations right now are really, really pushing for a comprehensive caregiving infrastructure answer, right? So childcare to elder care, paid leave and supports for caregivers. I'm really pleased to see the Biden administration actually include those kinds of investments in the rescue plan, in the American Jobs Plan, in the American Families Plan. And I'm also I'm really excited to say that American business gets it too. Just last week at Time's Up, we launched the Care Economy Business Council, which was 200 businesses from JP Morgan Chase and Verizon down to the Soul Food Popped Popcorn Shop in Texas, large and small businesses that had come together to say they know employers need to be part of the solution around caregiving for their employees if we're going to have a diverse, equitable workplace, which is what every business and our economy needs to be successful in the 21st century.
Okay, so some really urgent, urgent before, but really urgent post-pandemic, particularly with a sort of economic recovery lens and gender justice and gender equality lens laid over that, make it particularly urgent right now. Jordan, what about you? What would be your answer to, you know, is there I think you have an answer, but I'd love to hear a bit more about, yes, this is a particular moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, Tina just said all that so well. So I agree with everything there, and I won't repeat the things that Tina already said, but I'll add another piece to it, which is not necessarily a different piece, but an additional piece, because while I think it's really important, we have to look at all of that gender equity in terms of helping women and helping gender nonconforming folks and helping folks who don't identify as men, basically, find more equality within the home and the workplace. I also want to say why I think it's urgent for men and why I think that is why I wrote father figure. And I think there's two different ways to do it. One is what I already said about that. I think the emotional, psychological struggle that men are going through right now. But I also think there is an economic issue, which is we are now a communications economy. And men traditionally have been taught not to communicate, right? They've been taught, Tina was talking about the industrial age. The industrial age is when we got a whole lot of our distinctions between men and women and these ideas about where their innate differences are, that women are better multitaskers and better at relationships, and men are just tough and angry and independent, and which is all nonsense, and the science doesn't back any of that up. But what happens in that is we have generations of education that have taught men to not have the skills to be able to empathize, to be able to communicate, and now we have an economy that's super dependent on the ability to communicate, right? You can see, and what you have is a backlash of men who don't want to do that because they've been taught it's not manly, right? They don't, and you see these things like the resistance against things like pronouns, listing pronouns, talking about pronouns, for example, where you have to do it in any major corporation, right? That's a major communication about understanding and creating a safe workspace for multiple people. Men aren't quite prepared for that. They've always been taught sort of stick to your guns, do the things that matter to you. You don't have to cave in any ways. And so what we have to do is undo some of that socialization, not just because of the emotional burden that it causes for men, the psychological burden, but also I think they're just not going to be able to compete in a changing economy if they don't learn how to talk in different ways, think in different ways, behave in different ways, and listen in different ways.
That's super interesting. One of the things that struck me when reading your book, Jordan, you have a little section where you talk about, this sort of leave it to beaver model of the family that sort of rose up in the 50s. Tina's nodding if you know the part of the book I'm talking about, where, you know, the man is the breadwinner and goes out and the woman stays home and takes care of the kid is really completely made up for that era of time. And never before was that ever the breakdown, really, because there wasn't enough food to go around. There wasn't enough money to go around. Like, you know, hunter gatherers, the women were working and foraging, and sure, maybe the men went to war and stuff. And, you know, there's different things, but both, you know, men and women were sort of equally working as a team. And I wonder if that sort of realization is a part of what you're trying to bring to people, Jordan.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, first I'll just get to that Leave It to Beaver 1950s family model, right? The only time in all of human history, right, when there was enough wealth for a single breadwinner family, it was in super wealthy white neighborhoods in the 1950s in America, right? All the rest of history has, I mean, certainly there are the outliers, the kings and the aristocrats who were able to have some, but everything else has always been everybody works, right? And for pre-industrial era, everybody works at home. There's not even this nonsense narrative we have of the men go to work and the women stay home, right? You all go work out in the field. Actually, the children work too. We didn't even come up with the idea that children should have a whole life of learning before they become adults until the industrial age. In order to do what happened in the industrial age, which is to create a place where men go to work in factories, in office buildings, in coal mine, you know, in any of these industries, there had to be a division created between home and work. And what happened, and that was in order to deal with a previous moment of psychological instability, right? People were like, wait, I can't just change our whole lives. So what they did was they came up with this origin story. And of course, when I say they came up, I don't mean that there was a secret cabal somewhere that came up with it, right? I just mean that slowly it evolved into a narrative where we started to believe that there was something natural and historic about the man going to work and the woman staying home and doing the caretaking. What also had to happen at the same time were these stories about gender essentialism, right? This idea that there are essential characteristics that are somehow connected to your genitals, psychological characteristics, cultural characteristics, right? And you can see how this works. So what they decided was, in order for men to work in factories, we had to start to imagine that men were naturally cold, like steel, like clogs, like, right? And then women, we had to start to imagine, created this nurturing household. So we started to say they're natural nurturers, right? And that is really, we still believe this on some level. And in some cases, it, you know, there's nothing natural about it, but at this point we've been socialized where there is a little bit of truth within it, just out of practice, right? If everyone's trying to teach you how to nurture for years and years and years, you're going to be better at it than the person who no one taught to nurture, obviously. But that's not, there's nothing innate there. There's no biological difference there. So that had to get created, and we're still buying into a lot of it, and we're still using the inequitable hierarchies of that industrial age way of thinking, which maybe it made sense then. I wasn't there. I can't decide whether it made sense then. But what I do know is that it doesn't make sense as we move forward. What I do know is that we need to reinvent it as we move forward. And what we've done, because we're so disoriented and uncertain, and it feels so unstable to move into a world that we don't understand yet, a lot of people are going, let's go to what feels good and familiar. But that's backwards, right? That's not, that had a million problems too. The world's always going to have a million problems, but hopefully we're going to evolve in ways where we acknowledge those problems and change our behaviors, change our culture, change our economic practices, and change our family practices. Family is one that I wrote about this in The New Childhood, and I wrote about it a lot in Father Figure, obviously, is one that we seem super duper resistant to even looking at, right? It's right. Like we want to believe it's so core and fundamental and essential, and it's just not true. I mean, go read anything ancient. It's polygamy. It's tribal parenting, right? Like this idea that there's something eternal about the cis hetero monogamous family is just crazy. And again, I'm not saying we need to get rid of the cis-hetero monogamous family. I'm just saying we have to acknowledge that we're choosing to keep it, and therefore, what are we going to keep about it, and what are we not going to keep about it?
Got it. And it, Tina, I'm going to come to you because so much of what Jordan just talked about is really around sort of changing our normative values, beliefs, and the way we're socialized. Like, I thought it was a really good point. You know, you might get better at being caring and caretaking if you're socialized to do it for your whole life, and your mother has been, and your grandmother has been, and you're socializing your boys and, you know, your fathers and your uncles and the men in the world not to. And you talked about Time's Up, tackling sort of those norms through the content of the industry. And I know that you have a lot of things you're trying to do at Time's Up. So I wanted to ask you, you have three main goals. Like, I'd like to ask you sort of, what is it you're really hoping to achieve? Like, what is it when you feel you've achieved, Time's Up could go out of business, what would the world look like?
Yes. Well, you know, look,
And what are you doing about it? Right. Yeah. Like, so yeah, tell us.
So we started, you know, and from a moment of survivor justice, right. And combating sexual harassment and standing with survivors and continuing to, you know, to do that work is important. And we still continue to do it, but we also imagine a world where sexual harassment doesn't happen in the first place, right? That's the goal, right? The goal is to have what, you know, we have reduced down to saying safe, fair, and dignified work for everyone, right? That's really the goal. And to do that, you've got to upset the power balances that exist. This is the patriarchy that Jordan is talking about. And, you know, we've zeroed in on the workplace as the kind of playing field that we're in, among the many playing fields, as you and I know, where that power balance needs to get upset. And we do it, you know, through changing culture, companies, and laws. That's what we say, right? So obviously legal change, doing public policy changes on, you know, what those structures are. But we can't just stop there. You know, we do need to support companies, as I've said, you know, like this Care Economy Business Council. I feel quite strongly that, you know, and I know this from my practice, having been a lawyer for a lot of companies, you can change company policy overnight, right? You know, if a CEO decides he wants to get paid leave tomorrow, he or she can do that. And they don't have to wait for Congress to do its work or not, right, over the next several months to do that. So, you know, for too long, we have not helped companies do that. And we've got to recognize, you know, so much like what Jordan talks about, you know, we don't necessarily know the right structures or strategies. I will say everything we've been doing for the last three decades, and I've been a part of helping to do those, has been insufficient because we are still where we are. So we have a research lab at Time's Up. We've been doing a lot of work in this space because we think we need to do more research, right? Mm-hmm. How do you do things like behavioral science? How do we behavioral design? How do we apply that to these problems? But then finally, changing culture, right? We've got to also change the broader culture, the broader cultural narratives that are out there that shape, you know, how so much of our normative thinking, of the values, you know, all of the images that Jordan's talking about, right? You know, are reinforced, right? Or not, you know, in our broader culture. That also means changing the culture makers. So this is why the work we do in Times of Entertainment, it's all kind of circular and feeds on itself. The work to build safe, fair, and dignified and equitable workplaces in the entertainment industry in particular is critical because those creators are the folks who are making the culture that we see, the people who are greenlighting various projects or not, right? Letting certain things come to the screen or not, or giving them awards, which is sort of why we just have been working most recently in Time's Up around a whole issue around the Golden Globes and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association that decides those awards. You know, a group that was revealed to have not a single black member for the last 20 years, right?
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I mean, problems, but I haven't been following that.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, and it's NBC just canceled the Golden Globes for next year. Because we've been calling it out. We've been calling for systemic change, not just because it's a small group of people over, which it is, right? It's 87 people in Hollywood, but they were making award decisions that affect our broader culture, right? And that's why, you know, culture is also a space that we need to address, you know, as well as companies, as well as laws, on how we do kind of the broad structural work that we need to do to kind of upset the power balances here.
What are some of the, and actually before I continue, there's a whole bunch of questions who've come in and I'm going to sprinkle them in as we go, but I wanted to tell audience folks, in case they don't know how to submit, tweet with the hashtag father figure. And we'll be scooping up your questions. Tina, what are some of the things that you feel particularly surprised by in terms of successes of Time's Up? because it's a relatively new organization. You just canceled the Golden Globes. Like you've got this new business, pledge or commitment. So you've been doing a lot. A lot is happening. What has really surprised you? Like, wow, I didn't know that would have worked so quickly. Like on the positives. Then I'm going to ask you about the negatives. What's like really a pain?
Well, it's true. You know what? We are like, 3 years old, this year, which as someone told me, and I think is apt, is, we're very much a toddler in all of this. So we're still completely finding our way. We're very much a startup, including the first year one of our existence. For a good part of it, there wasn't really an organization. We were trying to figure out, what do we do with this movement? So that is one thing that surprised me. I think we were all surprised coming out of this group of women who just really first got together to commiserate over recognizing they weren't alone anymore. That was what that reporting, the significance of, the Jodi Kantor and Ronan Farrow and Megan Toohey reporting in the New Yorker and New York Times was they ripped the cover off this just, widely held secret for three decades about sexual harassment. And all of a sudden these women from Hollywood who thought they were alone because they'd been kept alone, and not, discouraged from reporting, realized they were together. So the idea that first surprise, the idea that these women, and there was a growing, gathering, first it was a few room folks around a conference room table. Then it was an auditorium full of women, in November and December leading into this idea that we would launch something on January 1st. The idea that it took off with the velocity that it did, first with the New York Times reporting on January 1st, then the takeover of, ironically, the Golden Globes award show, where we kind of took it over, dressed everyone in black, put the pin on them. Oprah Winfrey gave her amazing speech. That just took off and it has remained. It's not a thing that just kind of went up and then went away. That momentum has sustained itself for 3 years. Is itself like the first big surprise, I have to say. And it is that we obviously touched a long held chord that had been covered up for so long among women and men, giving voice to that. But the second surprise, is that although business leaders are kind of nervous and remember, they are getting called out, mm-hmm. business leaders, not just in entertainment and elsewhere, you can barely pick up the news every day without a headline, right? In one industry or another of something going on, both in politics and government and tech industries and entertainment. And it still continues. I will confess, I'm a little surprised that 3 years in, people are still doing the same thing, but that's because it is so ingrained in our culture and what we do. But I do think that the confluence of demographic changes on the customers and the employees that businesses now need to attract, right? And this millennial generation cares about the values of the companies mm-hmm. that they want to work for, buy services from. I think the pandemic has accelerated that, and the crises that now even CEOs, the universality of the experience of the pandemic meant CEOs were stuck at home with their kids running around their background instead of being able to just go to the office and ignore the chaos at home that they might have been able to do in a different time. All of a sudden, I've seen business leaders have an acute awareness of these issues in ways they never did before, including even when we gathered them, Rebecca, for this White House Summit on Working Families, they were starting to kind of get it. They got the war for talent. I see an urgency today mm-hmm. on the part of Fortune 100 CEOs even, who realize that for small business owners who in the past used to say, I just can't afford it, now realize they need to figure out how to afford it because they need to attract people to work for their businesses and to succeed. So that probably would be the second surprise, is the speed with which this 180, right, on the part of businesses, let's be clear, 12 years ago, used to think caregiving, things like that were just things the workers had to figure out on their own. I'm not going to invest in it. It's a cost to my business. It doesn't return me anything.
Right.
They now see there's a huge return on investment. And if they don't make the investments, there's a huge, huge enterprise risk to the entire business. And that's surprising.
Yeah. And what I'm tying what you said to what Jordan said earlier about what's the urgency of the moment. Like there's this economic argument. Like if we don't reconfigure the roles of what it means to be a man and what it means to be masculine, like you're going to be left out of an entire shift. And like, maybe that's going to, and if the company's getting on board, maybe that's going to be sort of the thing that opens this whole thing up. I wonder if we look back that economic sort of piece. Jordan, what about you? You have four pillars in your book. You know, what do you see as sort of the solutions here?
There's so many things that need to be addressed, and there's so many potential solutions. In Father Figure, what I try to do is focus really specifically on the transformations that I think those who identify as men, those who identify as dads, really need to take in their own lives, right? And that's not to say that that's more important. I recognize, of course, and I say it often in the book, there are huge systemic things that have nothing to do with individuals changing their attitudes. That's not the answer, but that is something that has to happen simultaneously with systemic change. And so I tried to talk directly to the dads, and what I wanted to do for the dads is to teach them how, not to tell them how to be, right? This is not a book that's like, here's what it looks like to be perfect, right? This is not that kind of book. This is a book that says, here's the tools you can use to interrogate your own attitudes, your own behaviors, your own ways of thinking, so that you can come up with your own decisions about how to do that in a better way. I don't have like a rule book of like, you have to do A, B, C, D, and E. And I do have four principles about how you do that. We probably don't have time to do all four of them now, and if you want to read all four of them, you know, get the book. But but what I will say now, I'll talk about one because I think it's really relevant to what Tina just said, which is what I call switching away from narcissistic patriarchal authority. And I know that sounds like a lot of words, so I'll unpack it a bit, and I'll unpack it literally, right? Narcissistic. We often talk about narcissistic, and we just, you know, wrong. We talk about it to mean just self-centered. Everybody's self-centered. That's pretty, we mostly think about ourselves. But narcissistic is a step beyond that. Narcissistic is the ancient Greek story of Narcissus. The boy, he goes down to the pond. He sees his own reflection. He falls so in love with himself that he can't see anything but himself. And he just ends up staying there looking at himself all day. So I put that first in the idea of narcissistic patriarchal authority to say dads only see themselves. They see the whole story modeled around themselves, right? So that's the patriarchal bit. And then authority comes from the same root as author, right? It's the Greek root autos. And so it was this idea that dads are authoring the story of their lives and the story of all the peoples around them's lives, only thinking about themselves, right? So they see everybody else as sort of a supplemental character in this paternal narrative of like my kingdom. And what I'm encouraging dads to do is to switch that. I should say that's just a broader way about talking about the everyday examples that we have, like when you hear people say mansplaining or gaslighting. Both of these are the same example. This idea of a man believing that he's allowed to define the narrative that everybody else is going to abide by, right? One researcher, Cynthia Stark, calls this testimonial injustice, right? This idea that there's an inequality when it comes to whose testimony matters, right? And so obviously we all know that's true when it comes to issues of sexual violence still, right? That Tina and many other people are doing great work to try to balance that testimonial injustice in that case. But then I think what Tina was also getting at is there's a huge testimonial injustice in terms of questions of representation and who gets to define the story we use to socialize, who gets to define the cultural narratives, right? And we have it in our language, right? Father knows best. No, father doesn't know best. Father knows some things. Maybe sometimes he knows best because it's something he knows about, but that doesn't mean he knows best all the time. And so what I'm encouraging fathers to do in this book is to go, how do I shift away from that mindset of me being the center of my story and recognize that we're all living in a world where everybody's the center of their own story. And you might also be the villain in someone's story. And you might also be the mentor. And you might also be the like comedic sidekick. And, you know, you could be all those things. I can tell you as a father to teenagers, I'm often the villain in their story, in their minds. And I have two choices of how I deal with that, right? I can either fight back and go, no, you're wrong. I'm going to try to conquer. I'm going to keep, I can make it a kind of, metaphorical war for who's going to be the authority, or I can go, Okay, I get it. You need a villain now. Let's play with that. Let's talk about it. Let me hear the things that concern you. It doesn't mean that I'm going to let them be right all the time, but it does mean I have to acknowledge that I'm not in charge, right? And we all know, because we were all teenagers, that even when the tyrannical parent tells you you're wrong, you might eventually learn to get silent, but you don't actually change your mind.
I love it. I will say,
please go ahead, Tina.
To where you started, Jordan, is that, change has to happen both systemically and individually for change to really take root. And the kinds of changes we're talking about, let's be real, they are really deep. They are really deep. Mm-hmm. They are really longstanding. You know, I love how Jordan keeps pulling these back to these sort of origin, myths, as where they started, because literally I often say gender discrimination is like the one thing that has transcended time and race and gender and ethnicity and geography, right? Like it is everywhere. It has been for all time. This is how deep the change is that we're talking about. And to achieve them, you've got to operate on multiple levels. So, what Jordan's doing for individuals to give them a roadmap is something I hear because I'm working up at the structural level all the time where, I've got CEOs or somebody just telling me, I don't know how to have this conversation, right? Or I don't know how to enter into it. And so we've really got to be doing it all, right? To really work this change, which is both this very, deep individual work and helping folks reimagine what things look like differently. Because Jordan's right, we don't have the language. We weren't raised that way. We don't have a point of reference. So we've got to keep creating those for individuals. And then we also have to create the structures and reimagine the structures, both to reinforce the change, because you also can't just change the individual and then put them back into the old structures. And that will allow us, opening up those structures is going to, it's a virtuous circle here, will allow us to now create new narratives and new cultural norms that will help us sort of reimagine what our individual relationships are like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really helpful. We had a question come in, and I think you guys touched on it about, where do we go from here, both especially at the individual and structural level. So I really like that. It makes me think, Tina, what you just said, because I work in education, makes me think of the analogy to reimagining education. Everybody's like, well, retrain the teachers, make sure they have innovative pedagogy and know about 21st century skills, can do all this stuff. And you can train the teachers out the wazoo, and they can be brilliant and fabulous, and you stick them back in the same classroom with the same incentives, with the same testing, with the same principal, with the same sort of structures around them, and they will revert back to what they were doing before. So, you do need, that image comes to mind, and I think it's powerful for you guys to be talking about both levels. I want to bring in a couple questions from audience members. We have about 3 or 4 questions that are somewhat similar, and I'm going to group them. We have a couple. One is from Joe. One is from Cassandra, who says she's a parent. Another is from Allison, who says she's an artist. And they are asking about the generational differences. So, Joe says, how do you, he's talking about his own, he's reflecting on his own kids, 2 boys, 1 girl, and says, they are way ahead of where my peers are in just the language they use and the mindsets. We were talking about this in the green room before, and says, how do we get out of the way to let the next generation really shape the future? So that's one. And then another one is really around, I'm going to read it because I think it's interesting. What are the key ways being a feminist dad is different from just simply being a kinder, more equitable parent and partner? Mm-hmm. Is there something different? So, Jordan, why don't you start, and then Tina, over to you.
Yeah. Hold on. I'm trying to remember. What was the first question?
One is the age, like the next generation.
The age. Yeah.
How do we get out of the way and,
yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure that we need to get out of the way so much. I think it's certainly true that, this next generation is more comfortable with the kinds of progressive social justice changes that we're talking about, at least now. We'll see what they're like as they grow up. but right now, as a college professor, I see it every day. I see them not, we have this strange mythology in, I don't even know if it's mythology or just propaganda, that it's a generation of coddled kids who are afraid of conflict. And I can tell you, being the college professor in the classroom, that they are definitely not afraid of conflict, because they will stand up and fight for if I were to use the wrong pronoun for one of their friends, the entire class will stand up and confront me. I couldn't imagine as a kid being willing to confront my college professor for that kind of thing. So this idea that they're coddled and scared of conflict is just nonsense. They are strong. They're willing to fight for each other. They're willing to fight for themselves. They're willing to fight for the things that they believe in. And the things they believe in is much more more equity, right? Much more equality, much more equality of voice. Any idea that, that there's a silencing happening on campuses, I think is a little bit, is another one of these talking points that's just reactionary nonsense, because there is none of that. There is certainly conflict if they don't agree with you, but there's no shut up if they don't agree with you. They want to have the argument then. So in that sense, I think that's good. And I think our job as fathers, parents, teachers, caregivers, whatever we are, is not to get out of their way, but to help them, to help lift up that perspective, right? To help them learn how to use it even better, how to use it with more tact, how to use it with more diplomacy, how to leverage all these great ideas. One of the things that's in the way of that is what I was just talking about, that narcissistic patriarchal authority, right? We want to be, as parents, in charge. When I was first writing, I'll tell you a story that made me want to write father figure, which is I was with my kids and I was talking to them about their friends, and I kept using this wrong pronouns for one of their friends, and they kept calling me out. And I was so mad at them at that point. I was like, I taught you how to be a social justice warrior. How dare you? That's what's going on in my head. How dare you correct me, right? And as I was doing it, I thought, wait a second. If I, who has a background in feminist thought, who studied it in college, who studied it in graduate school, and feeling defensive and disoriented when my kids try to correct me, what about someone who doesn't have any of that? They must be feeling that level of uncertainty and shame and worry about whether they're losing authority at a much higher level. And so that was part of what I wanted to do, was to go, how can we find a place where we're able to support them without having to be the boss, right? Without having, and again, I'm not trying to say kids are the boss. I mean, this is certainly our job as parents is still to give them boundaries and rules and to guide them, but we don't have to always be the authority. We need to be the one that's responsible for their ongoing well-being. And so in that sense, I think that it's, it's not get out of their way and let them do it. It's help them do it. And it's help them do it even if it's not familiar to you. If it's not familiar to you as a parent, then you need to ask them to teach you and be able to have that sense of confidence to not be afraid to ask someone younger than you to teach you something. Right. The other question, which is how is it different? How is being a feminist dad different than just being a responsive parent? In some ways, it's not. In some ways, I think that, there's no really good, in all of my research, what I found is that there's really no good argument for gendered parenting in general, for gendered parenting roles, right? There's no way a father is supposed to be as the male parent. There's no good argument for that. Those arguments are usually made as a boy needs a father figure. That's what we use to try to stop marriage equality and things like that. The science doesn't hold up. That's clear on that. On the other hand, while I think certainly being a feminist dad at its most basic is the same as just being a good parent, if you think about the urgency of all the things that Tina and I have been saying about this particular moment, there's a particular need for men to be willing to model something different at this time for their boys and for their girls and for their gender nonconforming children, right? To show that there is a different kind of idea of what it means to achieve mature manhood. I don't even know if mature manhood's a good term, but if so don't.
Oops. Did Jordan just cut out, Tina, for you two?
I think so. Yes. Hey. I was worried it was
back.
Me.
Okay. He's back.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. You lost me for a second.
Yeah. No, it's okay, Jordan. I think we got you.
You got the point, though.
I think we got it, and it's powerful. You cut out for a split second, but it was fine. Tina, I want to ask you a really quick question, and then I think I have a closing question for you both. This is a question from Mbisa, who's based in Ethiopia at Addis Ababa University. So you've got a global audience here. And she is really asking about the terms gender equality versus feminism. And Jordan, you mentioned it right at the beginning. You said you go up to most dads and say, do you believe in gender equality? They're like, yes. Are you a feminist? No. And she's asking, like, look, feminism has a female first intonation and interpretation in her world. What's your guidance, Tina? Like, what terms do you use? If you're a savvy social change maker, what would you suggest?
Well, that's interesting. I because I was a lawyer, so I sort of know the both the power of words and context, you know, and the way to use them. And as an activist, I will say I'm a little bit pragmatic, meaning, you know, I am not one to sort of hang on to particular word construct because that's what I'm hanging on to. And I tend to be more pragmatic about what are we trying to convey and what are the values underneath that to convey. And so, you know, I think certainly here in the United States, gender equity has become, you know, recently the term, you know, to really symbolize a constellation of issues getting at gender and gender nonconforming, but, you know, non-binary, you know, sort of people, you know, who are identifying as women or are non-binary, you know, the equality that we're trying to seek, you know, for them in a whole range of dimensions. I know in a global context, that concept actually is, the term gender equality is used to connote that, and gender equity is actually has been weaponized, I think, in some context as something different and lesser than that full equality that is what we talk about in the United States as gender equity, which is why, you know, honestly, in a context of, I would use context, right? I'm comfortable using either term, depending on how the context is of the listener, and having that full range of, you know, equity, right? Regardless of gender or your gender identity is really what we're talking about. Same with feminism in the sense that, you know, obviously I am a proud feminist, have been, you know, since those early days, as I described, learning about those issues. But I will admit that I suspect feminism comes loaded in its context with that view of recognizing the historical power imbalances, you know, with an edge to it and working to sort of set a more woman-centered narrative, right? Then, which sometimes means not an even narrative, but a more women-centered narrative that is predominant as opposed to what has been predominantly a male narrative. And so I think that sort of may be, you know, also the difference. Mm-hmm. My advice to the question is, mm-hmm. I honestly say is like, know your listener and what your objectives are and use whichever words will achieve that. I mean, that's me. That's my particular yep. viewpoint in that I'm all about the result in the end and less about my holding a particular affinity or affection one way or another to the particular way the words are organized.
Great. And that leads me you led beautifully into sort of my final question for both of you, which really is around the sort of how you have a successful movement for whatever term, gender equality, let's call it. And I wanted to ask you about cancel culture and where you see that as a problem, where you don't see it as a problem. You could maybe talk about what you mean by cancel culture. And the flip side of that is collaboration. Like, you know, we certainly know and we've seen from history, particularly in the US, that there are tipping points in social change movements. If you think about HIV/AIDS, if you think about civil rights, where the tipping point really has come when a whole wide range of diverse stakeholders and people join the movement. straight mothers from the middle of the country joining, making quilts for their gay children, whites joining civil rights movement, etc. So what is the balance between where do you see cancel culture? What should we be worried about? What shouldn't we be worried about? Is canceling the Golden Globes cancel culture? Is it not? And where do you see collaboration in moving this with a broad range of folks? In moving this movement forward, you each have 1 minute. Jordan, you go first.
One, I'm sort of resistant to the term cancel culture in general. I think it's a kind of boogeyman term that's been invented by people who don't want to take accountability for things. Whenever I hear someone say, has cancel culture gone too far? I kind of don't even know what they mean, because there's not like a secret boardroom of the cancelers somewhere who, right? Like, have some organizations made mistakes while trying to hold people accountable and done that in poor ways? Absolutely. But overall, I think my feeling on all of it is, and do I feel bad for those people who are at the end of those mistakes, whose lives were disrupted because of things that were handled badly? Absolutely. I just also feel terrible for the generations of women and people of color who have had their lives disrupted because of things they said. And I think I'd just rather focus on what's still a systemic power imbalance and not the few outlier cases where it's been where so-called cancel culture has been wielded in problematic ways. To Great. Your second, oh, I'm out of time. I
You're
had a
out
second.
Of time. That was perfect. That was beautiful. Tina, over to you.
Well, I'll try to be very, very quick. I mean, obviously I agree with Jordan in that cancel culture really is It's a shorthand and a misnomer and been misused for really accountability. And accountability means you need to go through a process to get to accountability. Just to stick with the Globes example, that happened after a process where we, at Time's Up at least, were calling for very specific reforms and to analyze the problem in specific ways. They didn't come through on a timetable they themselves had set. And so then the question remains, as the next award season starts, do you participate in that or not? Right. Okay. So it's a process. And I do think we do a disservice to social change by cutting the process off too early. Because if somebody resigns from their job before there's a real investigation and before you understand where the facts are, you actually haven't advanced anything and you're left with all sorts of questions, which come back later, right? If they haven't been understood. And then that all just also feeds into this notion of sort of the tipping point where we are. For everything I've said previously, I do believe we're at a tipping point. We're at a really critical moment where we could reimagine our workplaces, our economy, sort of the fundamental underpinnings of how we're organized. It doesn't happen by itself. So I want to make sure everybody understands demographic changes do not simply take hold and result in social change by themselves. Demographic changes can result in the reverse, meaning those who are losing out in the demographic change, as we become a minority-majority, country, you see right now in what happened January 6th and otherwise the rise of the concern of those who see themselves losing in the demographic shift, fighting back and pushing back. That can also take hold if folks who care differently about it don't seize the moment and take action. And so we're at that critical moment where it's not certain who's going to win the day, right? At this tipping point. And if you care about having the tipping point land in a particular way, as I do, obviously, you got to work really hard right now. This is not the moment to sit back and just say, oh, we got it, right? Biden's in the White House. This is happening over here. This is the moment to double down on the efforts for change, because that's the way we're going to make change take hold, because it can very easily go the opposite direction.
That was a great closing. I thank you very much. You have your call to action, everyone who's on the phone. Thank you, Jordan, for letting us talk about your new book, Father Figure, How to Be a Feminist Dad. And Tina, thank you for joining us and sharing with us your insight from a decade of service and what Time's Up is up to. So thank you both very much.